Hello there, this is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club of Australia, with a monthly news broadcast for members and friends of the club for July 2024. This month, instead of the usual broadcast, we will offer an historical broadcast from years past. The usual news and information will be broadcast next month. I'm Andrew, VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. I have broadcast files going back as far as 2001. Many of the older files aren't the greatest as far as technical quality goes, archived in either Real Audio or Windows Media Audio format. These produced a smaller file size back in the days when the leading edge technology was dial-up internet. Remember that? This month we have an original broadcast from June 2002. Details on when to hear these news and information broadcasts are available at the club website, www.raotc.org.au. The VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, 2-meter repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you miss the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email, raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's broadcast.
Hello there, this is Alan Doble, VK3AMD and Associated Relay Stations as VK3OTN, the official call sign of the Radio MNR Timers Club. The latest news from our secretary, Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, is not good. He reports that nearly 70 members have failed to renew their subscriptions, which were finally due by the end of April. And this is serious from two points of view. Subscriptions are our only source of income and the means to print and deliver a magazine. On the other hand, no subscriptions means deletion from the membership list in the magazine. I'm confident nobody has decided not to subscribe, only overlooked the date. If this is your situation, please gladden Arthur's heart and with your sub, which is still $8 per year or $15 for 2 years. Incorporation. As reported last month, we have lodged the necessary documents with the appropriate government department, but so far have not received any acknowledgement or comment. Excuse me. Amateur Radio Magazine. Those listeners who do not receive the WIA's AR Magazine may be interested to know that it is beginning to be available at some news agents in limited but increasing quantities. The June issue of the magazine, bought from news agents, will contain a free catalogue from JCAR, a well-known supplier of components. Subscribers will find a coupon entitling a free catalogue when making a purchase at any JCAR outlet. The news agent's price for the magazine is $5.95. An interesting item from the WIA Federal Convention is that the Ron Higginbotham Award for Outstanding Contributions to Amateur Radio Magazine has been awarded to club member Drew Diamond, VK3XU. Congratulations, Drew. In West Australia, the Alzheimer's Group will be having their regular luncheon meeting at the Bayswater Tavern at 12 noon tomorrow week, Tuesday the 11th. And today we welcome to membership Eric van der Weyer, VK2KUR, who becomes a full member number 1253, and Vic Self, VK3KSF, who becomes an associate member for the number 1254. It will be great to hear, or preferably these new members, either or both of them, identify themselves as one or the other, as well as any other recently joined members on one or other of our callback sessions. This is VK3OTN. We regret to report the passing from us of Lawrence Quigley, VK2DSB, who was member number 1106, Carl Alexander, VK4FAE, who was member number 1051, and George Nielsen, VK3TES, who was member number 856. George was best known for the years he spent at Kingsley Radio in the design and construction of the Kingsley AR7. We now pause for a few moments in memory of these friends. Okay, this is VK3OTN. A short item from Doug Charlton, VK7DK, reads as follows. And by the way, Doug's QDH is in the call book. He says, I've been fascinated by recent references to the Lockheed Hudson aircraft. On the 5th of August 1943, a Hudson aircraft crash-landed on our dairy farm at Leon Gatto in South Gippsland, Victoria. I still have a memento given to our family by the ground staff who attempted the crash site, and it is inscribed with the date mentioned above and also Hudson N28. All of the crew survived the crash, and I distinctly recall the navigator's comment to the effect that this was his third crash. The aircraft was dismantled and hauled off the sail, I believe. Perhaps someone may have additional detail about this particular aircraft. Should anyone wish to explore this matter further, I'd be pleased to assist. It sure would be nice to meet up with someone familiar with the occasion. And that was Doug Charlton, 7DK, and he's in the call book. This is VK3AMD and Associated Relay Stations. This is VK3OTN. From time to time, the long arm of coincidence reaches out to touch us. It happened to me a couple of weeks ago. Using pen and paper, I was drafting a letter which I planned to type later and send to my office at number in England, Dr. Ken Jones, G3RRN. To check the spelling of the name of the English club's secretary, I sorted through a varied heap of old magazines to find a copy of their OT news. I found the information I wanted on the inside front cover, and a headline on the opposite page identified the front cover picture as, quote, Dr. Ken Jones, G3RRN, a new president, the man I was writing to. That randomly chosen magazine turned out to be dated autumn 1998. Creepy, isn't it? This is VK3OTN. A major reason that prompted us to use our VK3OTN call sign to exchange greetings to our brother club in England on April the 8th when they used their special call sign GB75GBH from Tetley, the site of the Beam wireless transmitter to Australia in 1927, was with one of our early members, the late Maxwell Howden, who was then A3BQ, established the first ever two-way shortwave communication between Australia and England 3 years earlier, when he worked Ernest Simmons G2OD on November the 14th, 1924. Max was using 250 watts and 85 meters. I'll now read to you Max Howden's own story of that event in a very faded copy of a journal named Experimental Radio and Broadcast News. Some of the prints are a bit hard to read, but the story includes five pictures, including one of Max with his hand on the key. And here are Max's own words. It never rains but it pours. That was my feeling when G2OD answered my CQ call 4 minutes past five in the morning of November the 14th, after a lapse of only 10 days since I established the first two-way trans-Pacific communication. I forgot the earliness of the hour and my sleepiness and just waited and waited for him to sign his call. His tuning was so sharp that as soon as I found him, I knew he was a very distant station, and I thought that he was English by his very pure note. The Frenchmen, like the Aussies, being noted for their rattles. After keeping me in suspense for nearly 4 minutes, he finally signed off, and I immediately changed over and, increasing my filament current to make sure of things, sent him congratulations and greetings from Australia. I asked him for his power input and circuit. The beginning of his reply was hardly to the point, and I thought at first he had not read my transmission. But after telling me my signals were already fading, he returned the greetings, etc., and said his power was 190 to 200 watts, and what were his signals like at the distance? Well, they'd been very clear, but were just beginning to fade. So instead of sending him a detailed report, I merely gave him QRK and see you again tomorrow at 18:15 GMT. My signals had either faded or thought he was the air was too late, but his reply was okay, 1800 GMT, for good night, I guess. I sat back, lit a cigarette and studied my DX cards, wondering where is the best DX I can ever get would look best. It would depend on the size of the frame. After a while, I came down to Earth, or rather back to Australia, and remembered I was very sleepy and there was at least 2.5 hours before I could report, so I went back to bed. Therefore, though one of the shortest periods I worked to OD was easily the most satisfactory DX work I have ever done. Mainly, I think, because the receiving conditions were so good at both ends. About midday, I received a cablegram from Mr. Simmons confirming the establishment of the first two-way communication between England and Australia that morning, so I had not dreamt it. To this I replied, and the only part of his transmission the following morning that was readable through the QRN was his acknowledgement of my answer. We did our best to work again on the Sunday morning, but although we found each other before 4:50 a.m., we could not do much working owing to the heavy QRN at this end. Static was bad that night again, but I succeeded in working U1SF for over an hour. The following morning I stayed in bed, thinking that conditions would be too bad. They must have cleared a bit, for both 3BM and 3BD heard G2SZ and G2NM working slightly higher than G2OD and noticeably stronger. I tried again the next Sunday, the 23rd at 1800 GMT, and after listening for about 5 minutes, called GCQ and G2OD. The latter was apparently waiting for me, for he came straight back. This was the earliest I'd heard him, it being then about 4:15 a.m. Static was again too bad, too much. So, reliable reception, to have much reliable reception at this end. G2OD complained that for the first time since I started working with him. However, I sent him a message for old A3BK, who most will remember is now away in England for 2 years. Before he left, I told him he would probably hear from us while he was there, as the only link in the chain to England at that time unbridged was between New Zealand and Honolulu. Little did I expect to be dumping messages solid in England before half his time was up. G2OD gave me okay to it and sent one to me in return. It read, "Congratulations on Aussie amateur work, signed Amory, Commercial Secretary." It took me 3 attempts before I got that, and I still don't know who it was. Two, although said 4AA related on to another Australian station the following night. We were able to keep in touch with one another until 5:15 a.m. on Sunday, but although I tried for over an hour on Monday morning, I heard nothing of him. G2NM, however, was doing local work at about 20 words per minute from, I can't read the time, until about 0:40 and was very easily readable. That is all the two-way communication that has taken place so far, but we're hoping for better conditions when the weather clears. A brief description of the instruments in use at this end may be of interest. The transmitter is a three-core Meissner fed by a big homebrew transformer delivering about 1500 volts through an electrolytic filter consisting of a number of jars into a Phillips Z4 tube which passes just on 100 milliamps at that potential. The aerial is made up of a 50-foot fine wire cage suspended by hemp rope between two 80-foot masts. The five wire tapering cage lead-in comes from the exact center of the horizontal cage and is 80 feet long, being connected to the set by a 1-inch copper strip. The counterpoise is 6 100-foot wires on 15-foot spreaders. The wires are bunched in the center at the point where the lead is soldered, thus giving it the form of a double fan. There are no low loss condensers in the SIP, but have not yet managed to make them smoke. The receiver consists of a detector with one stage of audio. The coils are wound with 16-gauge DCC wire and cardboard tube with 5 turns primary, 14 turns secondary, and 11 turns tickler. The secondary is shunted by a 300305 condenser with moulded mud ends. That ends Max Howden's own story of a history-making achievement, a giant step in wireless long-distance communication. The Max Howden receiver, now held at Science Works Museum, is very old, but is not the set that's described in this story. This is VK3AMD and VK3OTN. Here we have a story from Ron Cook, VK3ASW, who muses about crystal sets. I discovered the crystal set before I could read or write. It lived in a drawer in the wash house and seemed very heavy. I knew it was special, so I used to lift it in and out to struggle back to the back door with my arms wrapped around it. It was maybe 4 years old. I was maybe 4 years old. Mum would take it off me and put it away. How often this little game went on, I don't know. But one day, instead of setting this polished box on the tank stand, I let it slip, and a funny little glass cylinder that housed the cat's whisker was born. After that, my mother gave up, and I amused myself dismantling the whole assembly. I never did find the cat's whisker, but there was a little bit of springy wire where the whisker should have been. The set took me some time to destroy completely. I recall a drawer half full of tangled silk-covered copper wire, and even today the odd aluminium plate from the tuning capacitor will turn up in the sand in the backyard. Apparently I acquired some skill with a screwdriver and pliers at this time. By the time I was 10, I bitterly regretted that Mum had not given me a thump and put the set higher up and out of my reach. I have now forgiven her, but from the time I had a different sort of interest in crystal sets until I was an adult, I resented the fact that I'd been allowed to smash up a good crystal set. They still hold a fascination for me today. At about 10 years of age, I discovered the book Crystal Sets and How to Make Them. It belonged to my father. He and his brother had built a set according to instructions, but heard nothing possibly because the farm at Berry's Creek was too far away from the nearest transmitting station. Dad kept the book for many years until I found it and read it from cover to cover one winter. In those days, I'd become a voracious reader and tried to read every book in the house. It took me some 3 years to save up enough money to buy a pair of headphones and a tuning capacitor, that was 10 shillings, plus some enameled wire for a coil. Eventually, a working crystal set emerged and I was able to listen to 3AR and 3LO. I could just hear but not understand VK, at least forget the VK, I could just hear but not understand 3UZ and could hear another commercial station, perhaps 3DB. Many hours were spent in listening to radio plays when I should have been sound asleep. Later I found other boys in nearby Geelong had crystal sets and they could only get 3GL, but it was loud. I tried to call with many less turns, and I too could hear the local station some 12 miles away. But I seemed to have let a genie out of the bottle, for after that I could not listen to any station without hearing 3GL in the background, if somewhat faintly, on 3LO and 3AR. I rebuilt my crystal set many times in search of perfect selectivity and great sensitivity, but always 3GL was there somewhere. I gave up building crystal sets when I was given a valve and some batteries by a kind-hearted serviceman and became a regeneration receiver fiend. Recently, one of the radio clubs held a crystal set competition. I started out to build a new set. Unfortunately, I became ill and didn't finish it till after the competition. As when I was first building these things, I experimented with different detectors. I finished up with a hot carrier diode, maybe that's cheating, but no more so than using an OA5, and a computer speaker with a built-in audio amplifier. I found it could hear all Melbourne stations at good strength with little or no interference from just a single coil and a small aerial. Yes, it's my best crystal set yet, but using the audio amplifier does make me feel a bit uneasy, as I feel that having any battery or mains power defeats the idea of a self-powered radio. I might make a second set tuned to a local station and use the power from that to run a small amplifier. That would enable the main set to run lightly coupled for better selectivity and still provide maybe a milliwatt of audio. Yes, the possibilities of the old crystal set still intrigue me. In the meantime, I can listen to the set in the garage when working on other things. I once had an involvement with an X-band microwave crystal set. The Jindavik pilotless aircraft, designed and manufactured at the government aircraft factory at Fisherman's Bend, was at one stage fitted with a radar transponder. This used a simple crystal with an IN23 diode followed by a 1 MHz amplifier. The received radar pulses were 1 microsecond duration, so a 1 MHz audio amplifier could be used to raise the level of the pulse sufficiently to fire a magnetron oscillator that emitted a very loud return pulse. The receiver system had a usable sensitivity of about -60 dBm. The amplified pulse made the Jindavik look like a very large bomber on the X-band radar. The delay from receiving the pulse to generating a local magnetron pulse ensured that the aircraft was not where the radar indicated, which was a possible advantage when live firing at the target commenced. The antenna used on the aircraft were quarter wave verticals. At 10 GHz, a wavelength is 30 millimeters, so the verticals were all of 7 millimeters long. I wonder how my latest crystal set would go with a full-size quarter-wave vertical on 400 meters coupled to it. Interesting story from Ron, BK3AFW. This is BK3LTN. And here we go again, a book review. During a visit to a local library recently, I picked up an interesting wartime story, nothing to do with radio or signals. It's the personal story of an Australian infantryman who landed in Singapore near the end of January 42. Surrender occurred 8 days later after a lot of confusion plus lack of supplies or direction. He was imprisoned in Changi, but was determined to escape, which he did with one other friend. They stole a small boat to get to the mainland and worked their way up the east coast, hoping to cross to the west coast and somehow escape to perhaps Burma. It was not to be. They were betrayed to the Japanese by a group of Malays and Indians and eventually finished up back in Changi. It's a well-told story of courage and suffering. The details of the mindless savagery and brutality of the Japanese are horrifying. The title of the book is Singapore Samurai. The author is Penrod B. Dean, D-E-A-N, published in 1998 by Kangaroo Press in Sydney. The ISBN number is 0-86417-9324. I'll repeat that. 0-86417-9324. Penrod Dean is a West Australian. He learned Japanese and was one of 10 Australian servicemen to be taken to Japan and give evidence in the war trials there. The book's about penguin size, 160 pages with a good index. It's a VK3OTN. Kong Harvey, VK1AU, has sent the following notes about his friend John Gerber, VK1EG, his passing we reported in last month's broadcast. It's headed in the olden days. Looking back from today's technology, it's hard to realize that in 1936 our National Railway Service once depended on Morse code for control of railway freight trains. 19 years old, John Gerber was a supply messenger at Spencer Street Station when he qualified as a second-class and then a third-class railways telegraphy operator. These certificates of competency authorized him to be employed as a junior telegraphist at Flinders Street Station, sending details of the desired makeup of freight trains to station masters throughout Victoria. In January 1937, he joined the RAAF as a trainee WT operator, completing number 6 course in June 1938. RAAF WT duties such as point-to-point circuits, aircraft watches and MFDF stations and flying duties kept him busy. But in 1940, he was ready to sit for and pass the PMG's Department First Class Commercial Operator Certificate of Proficiency, receiving certificate number 382. This required him to demonstrate, among other skills, correct reception of code words in 20 words per minute and plain language in 25 words per minute. It's not generally known that a first-class certificate could be cancelled or suspended at the discretion of the Postmaster General for incompetence, misconduct, or breach of the regulations. His original certificate went astray during the war years and was replaced in 1947 by number 1174. It was this certificate that entitled him to an amateur license in 1970. And we have some copies of his certificates, but I think they might be a bit pale for reproduction in OTN. And here's a short item from John Saunders, BK2DEJ. Talks about crystal sets again, strangely. In the late 1940s, I had a go at making a crystal set and was a disaster. Looking back, I can see why. I lived in a flat at Bondi Beach. The antenna was all of 20 feet long. As we lived on the second story, there was no earth lead, so it was going to be valves to the rescue. At the time, I was an avid reader of radio and hobbies at 6 months a time, so a set was built using a 6J7G regenerative with a 6FG6 output and a 5Y3G for the high tension. This was not enough, and I had to build a short-wave receiver, which became the first of many. At the same time, I used to ride my bicycle all over the place. I discovered an on-antenna above a house in Bronte. It turned out to be a W8JK belonging to VK2FJ Jack Ferguson, a member of the local fire brigade, generally known as Fireman Jack. His house was an Aladdin's cave to me. You had to walk sideways through the hallway through the house. There were crates and boxes all full of wartime disposed and sale. You name it, it was there somewhere. And as a grand finale, in his shack was a rack-mounted transmitter that took up the whole rack. Wonder of wonders, the rectifier was a set of 4 866s and a bridge rectifier. Never before had I seen such a sight. Jack was very kind to me and helped me over those first years. Eventually, it all came to an end. Jack lusted for a rotary beam to replace the old W8JK antenna. Being a fireman, he was able to finagle one of those hose-drying towers that all fire stations used to have. Up it went, the howls of horror from all the neighbours who didn't know a good thing when they saw it. Then the local council descended on poor old Jack. In the end, Jack decided that if he couldn't build his tower in Bronte, he'd sell up and go to some civilised place where he could. We also moved away from Bondi Beach, and I lost contact with him. But I've never forgotten Fireman Jack, who gave me such a good start. That was a nice story from John Saunders, VK2DEJ. This is VK3OTN. In this modern age of hair-trigger litigation and problems with third-party liability insurance, the greatest worry for most golf clubs is what massive sum it might be sued for due to a stray ball going over the boundary fence. There was a case where a young married couple were playing golf, and this hit ball did go over the fence and break a window in an adjoining property, making a loud crash and scattering glass everywhere. They hurried to speak to the man who came out of the house and apologized profusely and offered to pay for the repairs. To their surprise, the man said there was no need for that. In fact, he was in their debt. He explained that, in fact, he was a genie. He said, "I'm a genie and I've been cooped up in a bottle for 1,000 years and your golf ball broke the bottle and released me. So I'd like to repay you by granting your dearest wishes." After a little thought, the husband said, "We would like to become scratch golfers." The genie clapped his hands and said, "Done. What else do you wish?" The wife said, "We'd like to become millionaires." The genie clapped his hands again and said, "Done. $100,000 will be paid into your bank account every month for the rest of your life." They both thanked him and asked, was there anything they could do for him to show their gratitude? The genie appeared to think for a minute or two, and then, rather hesitantly, he said, in all those years in the bottle, what I longed for most was to spend a night in the arms of a beautiful woman. I don't suppose that they got his meaning. And after a brief conference, it was decided that the wife would go along with his wishes, as after all he had done so much for them. We don't have details of what happened during the night, I'm sorry to say, but in the morning the wife was leaving for home, and the genie asked how old she was. She replied, 29. The genie said, 29, eh? I'm so glad to find you still did believe in genies. And on that happy note, I'll leave you until July the 1st. And just while I'm at it, for the information of listeners to this transmission, membership of this club is available in two grades. Associate membership for amateurs who have been licensed for 10 years or more, and full membership for amateurs who have been licensed for 25 years or more. Annual subscription is $8 per year for either grade. Both grades receive two copies a year of our magazine, OTN. This is Alan Doble, VK3AMD, and associated relay stations is VK3ATN, the official call sign of the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club of Australia. We now conclude our transmission for this month and hope you found it interesting. We'll be on the air again on Monday the 1st of July and Monday the 5th of August at the same time as today. Times and frequencies are published in the pricing page that came with your magazine. Please stand by for the call and back session on the frequency you've been listening to. Thank you for listening. And 73. Da-da-da-da-da.
You have been listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia. This concludes this month's news and information bulletin. The next RAOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies, and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. 73 everyone.